I'm Chad Reed.
I'm Hillary Langer.
I'm Gil Jenkins.
And this is Climate Positive.
The way climate action will succeed is if you bring people along. And what does it take to not just have the technocratic ideas, but also the ability to explain those technocratic ideas and show the impact that they have on people is what is going to unlock whether 2024 goes in the way of good climate action or bad climate action.
This week on Climate Positive, we're thrilled to welcome Akshat Rathi, senior reporter for Bloomberg News, host of the Zero podcast, and author of a fantastic new book called Climate Capitalism: Winning the Global Race to Zero Emissions and Solving the Crisis of Our Age. Climate capitalism takes readers on a journey across five continents, tracking the unlikely heroes driving the fight against climate change. These narratives reveal how people, policy, and technology are converging to create a green economy that is not only possible, but profitable. I've been a big admirer of Akshat's work over the years, so having the opportunity to sit down with him and delve into the key insights from his book was quite special. I hope you find our ensuing discussion as engaging and enlightening as I did. Akshat, welcome to Climate Positive. Thank you for doing the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write Climate Capitalism and how you find time to do this, given your prolific reporting schedule and podcasting duties?
I mean, I started because I wanted a fun challenge, and that when I was trying to look at whether solutions are scaling around the world, I was finding examples everywhere. And it was a moment, at least when I pitched the book in 2019, where what I was seeing wasn't quite aligning with what people were feeling or people's perception of where climate solutions stood. So initially it began as an idea that I'm going to try and tell you about the places that you don't know about where these solutions are scaling, or you don't know how they scaled, because either they are happening in places that are hard to report from or hard to have visibility in, or are places where typically you don't get media attention going. But you know, as with books, it's a long journey. You take a long time to report them, write them, edit them, put them down. Own thinking about it evolved. And what I ended up with was a series of success stories at scale, but all of them kind of working in the capitalistic framework that we have and like tweaking it to make it work for tackling climate change, which is sort of, again, going against the grain of general environmental movement that says, look, it's the economic system. Unless you change it, we're not going to fix this problem. And we are starting to change it. You know, people would like to rip it apart and replace it with something. I don't know what that was, but at least we are starting to change it, and we're doing it in different ways around the world. And the book gives you examples of where that's happening and how to think about creating a framework for getting to zero emissions based on those success stories.
Totally share that worldview and appreciative of your work to put this all together in such a cogent and arresting read. Before we dig into a little bit more on the motivation behind the book, which you touched on, and the themes and some of the specific sections, I do want to just take a moment to have our listeners learn a little bit more about your own story. What inspired you to transition from a background in, is it organic chemistry and chemical engineering, to journalism? And then was there a moment, and you do talk about this in the book, where you really started to dig into climate solutions? So I know that's a multi-part, but you have a great anecdote in the book that I'd love for you to share.
Yeah. Well, the book kind of starts with Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, where he's talking about clean coal. And my editor's like, what the hell is that? And, you know, I was a science reporter at the time, and I was like, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. but it's a thing, you know, it is a technology. You actually don't just take the coal, clean it, and then burn it. You actually take the coal, burn it, then clean it up by capturing the emissions. And my editor was like, wow, okay, is that a thing that works? I'm like, yeah, there are two coal power plants in the world where it does work. And he's like, well, maybe we should look into it, do a story about it. And that ended up becoming a long series looking at carbon captures, both opportunities and pitfalls, because it's been around for 50 years. And, you know, that series kind of took off and viral. And as things happen, you know, it sort of hit a moment in the energy transition Trump having been elected and all these movements trying to figure out how to keep climate action going in the face of a presidency that was opposed to it. How I came to it was sort of circuitous. You know, I grew up in India. As you do, if you know math or science in India, you're going to become an engineer or a doctor. And so I did chemical engineering. I mean, I suppose the only choice I made was I wanted to do chemical engineering rather than just engineering because I like chemistry. And then the desire to study more chemistry ended up with me having to study for a PhD at Oxford doing organic chemistry. And I was on the path to be a professor. At least that was the goal with which I started my PhD. But somewhere in the middle, I was like, nah, the life of an academic is not for me. And I used to write as a hobby. And so I thought, well, maybe I could put some of my science skills to use here. It feels like there is room for better coverage of scientific topics for a general audience.
Yes, that's a very diplomatic answer. There is indeed room.
So yeah, so I ended up doing that. So I started with science and then, of course, Trump happened. And so now I'm a climate guy.
I first met you like in the hallway of the Atlantic Council during the Trump years. I can't remember the context, but we were, I think, in the same mode of reacting to what does this mean for climate action? And you were chronicling it and I was advocating for the American renewable energy business. And what an interesting time that was for both of us, and maybe will be again. Anyways, we'll get into that later.
Yes.
Let's expand a bit more on the themes of the book that you touched on at the top. You know, obviously this notion you talk throughout in the beginning and throughout in the end, you know, very simply, it's cheaper to save the world than to destroy it. And you illuminate that through these players that you chronicle who are sort of sitting at the intersection of politics, technology, and finance. Do you want to maybe expand a bit more on how you arrived at that theme before we jump into some of the rich narratives chronicled in the 12 chapters?
I feel like another thing you have to do with books is to find your niche, right? There is growing literature around climate, and that's good. There's more journalism in the climate space. That's good. And so when I was trying to write this book, A, I wanted to focus on the solutions and what lessons we can learn from it. But I also wanted to figure out why they work at a very high macro level. And to me, the distillation of that is it's cheaper to save the world than to destroy it, because the economic case for climate action has now been made for many years that the cost of doing something to reduce emissions, to meet climate goals, will be lower than the cost of dealing with the impacts that may come if you don't. Now, that is true at a macro level globally. That's true on a country level. In most countries, it's not always true at an individual's level. It's not always true even on a regional or a city level. But how do you take what is a clear economic case, but then make it work for all players in that space was sort of the animating point that I could bring through with the book and with the examples. Of course, there's a long way to get to net zero. And so you will need fundamental drivers that will push it. Obviously, technology has been one, and that's made the economic case easier because we have clean technologies that have been getting cheaper and cheaper, barring the inflation adjusted period of the last 2 years, but you know, have been getting yes, cheaper and yes. cheaper. So that's
still helped. Cheaper than many of the incumbents.
Yeah. And the second thing that's helped is, sadly, climate impacts are here and you can see them and you can feel them and you yourself are affected by them. Almost all of the planet has people affected by climate impacts. Not everybody understands those. Not everybody appreciates the climate linkage of these extreme weather events, but more and more people do. So you've got that second force, which translates into a political force, into a campaigning force, into an activist force, but it's sort of the people force that's there. And then finally, even if you have the motivation from people to act and the technology is getting cheaper, you still need something that unlocks the politics, and that is policy. And to me, this book, you know, it's climate capitalism, it's climate modifying capitalism, it's climate finding ways to shape policies so that capitalism can actually be a solution rather than a problem.
I want to ask you later about reactions and maybe some of the criticisms. You alluded to the literature out there in the climate world. I'm sure you may observe, as I do, that sometimes the loudest voices in our space are focused on the doom, and that's real, but it's also, I think there's plenty of science that suggests that that is the worst thing we could do for action. It breeds inaction at this moment in time. We need that for the awareness. And then you've got the struggle with, you know, sort of anti-capitalist views. I love that very early on you cite Noam Chomsky, who himself acknowledges that there's no possibility of overthrowing capitalism and managing the change we need on the timescale that climate change requires. So I thought that was very deft of you to put that in early. Is that kind of what you were getting at? On, you know, focus on the solutions without being Pollyannish. Bring in the notion of reforming capitalism. It's a system we have largely throughout the world, and the opportunity is increasingly being recognized.
Yeah, I think if you spend any time trying to grapple with the challenge that is climate change, you quickly get overwhelmed by how big it is, how much needs to be done, how big the forces against it are. And, you know, doomism is, I would say, a natural reaction. You sometimes do feel helpless, and climate anxiety is real. You know, it sort of shows up in this level of activism that has grown up, which is people are taking to the streets because they are so motivated once they realize how big a challenge this is. So it's not to say that, no, don't be a doomist. I think all narratives are valid given how big the challenge is.
That's right.
But the thing that needs to happen after you acknowledge the challenge is that you have to do something about it. And for different people, it might be different narrative that might force them to do something about it. Some people prefer to have the sort of apocalyptic optimism where they go and talk about how bad things are going to be, and that fires them up. For other people, it's, look, this is going to be a better world because the solutions are actually making everything better. It's not just about reducing emissions. It's about opportunities. It's about jobs. That's the way to get them motivated to do more. And for other people, it might just be, look, here's an opportunity. I'm going to make businesses work. I'm going to make a ton of money because that's where governments are going to be forced to act now. And I'm an entrepreneur and I want to try and solve a problem and make money. Whatever gets you motivated, it really isn't about the reason behind it. It's about what you do with it.
That's beautifully said. Thank you for that. Let's talk specific chapters. I want to start by something that may be surprising to our listeners since we're talking about capitalism today, but could you share more on the story of chapter 3 about the Chinese bureaucrat, Wang Gang, if I hope I pronounced that right, behind China's rapid growth in EVs, and more about that playbook? I was fascinated by that story. I'd never heard of this gentleman before.
Yeah, it's if we write history well, and we typically don't because it's the winners who write history, but if we did write history well, he will stand taller than Elon Musk. That's not an overstatement.
Wow.
He is a Chinese born during the Cultural Revolution, during a period where the Chinese Communist Party thought cities had gone mad and that urban rich people had gone mad and that they had to go to farms to learn the ways of the way Chinese people live. And so he was, you know, sent to farms and he found himself repairing tractors. And that's sort of the passion for automobile engineering that he got during that period. Came back, studied in China, then got a PhD fellowship through the World Bank to go and study in Germany, got a PhD in automobile engineering, and then got a job in Audi, rose up through the ranks as an immigrant does, and is motivated to make the most of having left your country to pursue opportunities. But by about 2000, he was also feeling high-level bureaucrats coming from China to Germany, to Audi, but to other automakers to learn the art of how to make cars better, because the Chinese made cars, but they weren't as good as German cars were. And, you know, he gave them tours, but he also at one point saw that if Chinese were to live like Germans, they would have to burn 16 times as much oil per person per year. And there just wasn't enough oil in the world for that. And so he made the case to the science minister who was visiting that, look, it would be better if you find a new technology and one that does not use oil as a fuel source to command a new way of making cars. And I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. We know electric cars are a thing. Obviously, we'll need to make lots of advances to get there, but it would be a bet that if you make in the long term, you will succeed and maybe even benefit not just the people living in China, but also have an export industry. And that case he made to even the Politburo. He got to go all the way to the top and make that case and was given an advanced research program with a good amount of funding. He brought in academics and industry together over a 6-7 year period, showcased what that could be at the Beijing 2008 Olympics in electric cars and buses that ran and took the athletes around. But all the time, oil consumption was going up.
Yeah.
Car purchases were going up. And of course, air pollution was going up. And so by the time the Beijing Olympics happens, he is seen to be this guy who can deliver. And he's then given a mandate to try and expand this into a real industry. And so from 2009 to 2017, during his period as the science minister, he's given the job of science minister, the Chinese state invests $60 billion into lithium ion battery manufacturing and into EV manufacturing. Obviously, that's multiplied many times by private industry, and the results are for all of us to see. The biggest maker of electric cars and the biggest maker of lithium-ion batteries, not just in China, but globally, and now building them outside of China too.
Incredible story. Let's jump around the world. You talk in chapter 4 about India's notable strides towards solar power and a boom that began in 2015 and how it could provide a blueprint for sun-soaked tropical countries to transition. Tell our listeners about your story that you uncovered there.
So India is a developing country, not like China, because it does not have the economic heft that China does. So it doesn't quite have the capacity to be able to make huge capital expenses like China did to try and build an electric car industry. But what it is very good at is once some technology is at the cusp of becoming economical, it can take it and run with it because it's a very price sensitive environment. People only buy things that will actually be affordable and useful and be value for money. And, you know, the room for luxury is growing, but is very little. And so you get to a point by 2015 where the Indian government has recognized, look, solar is an opportunity for India. The prices have come down to a point where we can actually set really good, ambitious targets. But even after those two things are done, where there's a target and the technology is available, there are still so many other things that need to be overcome in a country like India or in any developing country, because doing business is hard. There's corruption, there's bureaucracy, but also in India, the population is large. And so finding land to be able to build so much renewables is hard. And so I wanted to try and see how, by the time I went reporting, India was building the world's largest solar farms and still does, you know, 2 gigawatts at a time, which is, you know, tens of thousands of football fields worth of land that you need. And I got a chance to go and visit this place in Karnataka where, you know, land had gone fallow because of climate change, but also droughts and extreme weather events. And India's had a difficult time with its degraded lands. lots and lots of farmers have committed suicide as a result of taking on debt that they couldn't repay because the land wasn't as productive. And in this moment comes the option of actually leasing your land for solar. And no, you don't get as much money as you would if it was productive land, but you get more money than you would if you didn't do anything with it. And so you get this perfect example of how to make a societal benefit out of not just reducing pollution, but actually creating wealth for the people who are deploying it.
Incredible. Let's go to chapter five, the International Energy Agency, which plays a vital and little celebrated role in influencing necessary changes on climate. Tell us about that story and why IEA is so transformational.
You know, in this ecosystem that we're going to have to build, it's not just technologies and it's not just national policies, but you need international organizations also to be a part of it. And obviously, the international meeting that we talk about every year in the climate space is the COP meeting. It's run by the United Nations and specifically the climate body within the United Nations. But it's only one of so many other international organizations that are involved in this process. I wanted to look at one that's transformed in a short period of time from being sort of the target of climate activists to being the darling of climate activists. And that is the International Energy Agency, sort of born in the era of the 1970s, the oil crisis, as a bulwark against OPEC, against the oil producing nations, as a group of oil consuming nations, so that you could get access to this fossil fuel on a secure basis at an affordable price. In the 2000s, it becoming sort of a ridicule of energy analysts in general, because it just couldn't keep up with clean energy trends.
Their projections were the running joke, being so far off.
Yes. And even the United Nations recognized that. So it created the International Renewable Energy Agency in 2009.
ARENA, yes.
And as a sort of fight against an IEA. So IEA was born as a fight against OPEC, and then IRENA was born as a fight against IEA. So yeah, it's that time where Fatih Birol takes on the role of leadership at the International Energy Agency and recognizes that if IEA is to be relevant in the 21st century, it has to try and develop skills that would not just be about ensuring energy security, which is its prime mandate, but also doing so in a period where that energy becomes cleaner over time and quite fast if it's supposed to meet the very climate goals that its own members have set. And that transformation takes about 5 to 7 years. And you're seeing the fruits of that. You know, now the IEA is actually targeted by oil traders as being too aggressive on clean energy. And so the response that I get from the IEA these days is like, look, previously we were attacked by climate activists, and now we are being attacked by oil people. I think we are doing something right.
Climate Positive is produced by HASI, a leading climate investment firm that actively partners with clients to deploy real assets that facilitate the energy transition. To learn more, visit HASI.com.
I want to ask you about Chapter 7, The Wrangler, and carbon capture, and the story of Julio Friedman. And you've mentioned earlier your great chronicling of this space. Tell us about what you uncovered there.
So Julio was a person who gave me sort of the education into carbon capture. He's somebody who spent time in ExxonMobil, in national labs, in government, in academia, in think tanks, and now in a startup. He's done sort of all these things in his career, and they've all been kind of related to carbon. He calls himself the carbon wrangler, and carbon capture has been a majority of that career. So to see how this technology, which has been around for 50 years, obviously around because it was useful, and that use was to actually extract more fossil fuels. So you capture the CO2, you put it in an oil field that's depleting and increase the production of oil. But because you're actually putting the CO2 into the ground, it actually stays there. And so you could use it for climate good. And since the 90s, a few ideas and few actual projects were being deployed to make use of this capability of carbon capture to do climate good. And so Julio comes in during the Obama era to try and figure out how to deploy some of these projects in the US. So the Department of Energy provides funding for some of these projects. And I take the example of two projects, one that is a success and one that is a failure, to try and learn what is needed. And the conclusion I come to is that, A, you need policy support, obviously, but B, you also need actors who are going to build these projects who are actually committed to the transition. And when you don't have those actors, and in this case, it is the oil and gas industry that's going to build many of these carbon capture projects, without having that support mechanism, you don't get scale up. So as Julio says, the butts in the seats matter. It's the people who are doing the work and what their motivations are matters. So it sort of comes back to the big framework that we have. It's not just policy and technology, but you need the people to make it work.
Would you agree that, at least in the US, given the enhancements to, I think it was known as the 45Q credit for carbon capture, we're starting to see that?
It's still been a mixed success. 45Q has been enhanced, and the amount of tax credit you get for each ton of CO2 that's being sunk into the ground is increased now. But the places where you can sink it, which are called as class 6 wells, which are regulated and have to be approved by the Environmental Protection Agency, have not been met with the scale of the deployment that is there. And that's why you haven't seen much steel in the ground yet. Yes, it's growing. There are lots more announcements, and some of them are reaching investment stage, but it's far from the pace at which you need to deploy carbon capture to be able to keep up with climate goals.
How about one more inspiring story you encountered during your research and covered in the book?
Well, I live in the UK, and I have a chapter looking at what the UK has done, which, you know, just purely objectively, the economy that has cut the most emissions since 1990. So the UK remains, on reducing emissions, the global leader. Of course, that sounds strange saying it today, where you have a prime minister and a party that is backtracking on climate goals, or at least rhetorically, not in policy. You know, they just announced an £800 million subsidy for offshore wind deployment in the UK. You know, in December, they announced a carbon border adjustment mechanism. So in policy, they're still going ahead because they are legally bound to do it. And that's the story I try and tell in the book, about how in 2008, a range of forces came together that created the perfect storm for all political parties to back the Climate Change Act, the first law that set a climate target in a parliament that bound a government to meet them. And that structure that was created, which was about how do you get from where we are all the way to zero eventually, but also through what are called carbon budgets, where you give a government a five-year period over which it cannot emit any more carbon. So you don't have to do it every year, you do it over a five-year period, so there's some flexibility, but those budgets keep reducing all the way to zero. And you create a watchdog, which is the Climate Change Committee here in the UK, which is an independent body that gives you annual report cards on where the government is and gives you advice on what the government can do. That ecosystem of having a law, having a watchdog, has been phenomenally successful. And it's now been copied around the world. And I wanted to tell the story of how it happened and why, despite what you might hear as rhetorical backtracking, the UK is still very much committed to its climate goals, because it just cannot get out of the legal nature of it.
Wow, we could learn a thing or two here in the United States.
And the thing that enabled it is actually bipartisan politics. Labour Party was in power at the time. it wasn't particularly interested in trying to do much on climate. And then the Conservative Party under David Cameron comes out and says, actually, we see that people want climate action and we're going to make it our campaign issue. And we're actually going to get votes because we're going to campaign for climate action. And in doing so, they force the Labour government to also up their game. And that's why you had this cross-party agreement to try and get a climate change act. And that's why the climate policies that have been set are only getting stricter and are continuing despite what the political rhetoric might be.
What do you think are the common traits or characteristics just on across all the stories that you share?
I mean, if you look at it from the sort of framework of people, policy, and technology, the people side is really crucial. And you see a lot of these are, despite their place in the ecosystem, really entrepreneurial at heart. They may not be running a business, but they're always creative in trying to solve a problem because we've just not done anything like this ever. And nothing like this that's going to change everything around us. And so you just have to, A, take on the size of the challenge, but then also come up with creative answers to that challenge. And a lot of these people have that entrepreneurial spirit. The other one is that because you have to do this everywhere all at once, you have to bring other people along. And so that is another thing that sort of shines through in all these people stories is how they unlock the rest of the ecosystem to come along on this journey. And we're going to have to do that a lot more. And then, of course, the technocratic side of it is also very crucial. So there's technology development, which we kind of know, and it actually works really well. We know exactly what we need to do. You deploy something at scale, and the more you do it, the cheaper it becomes in almost every case. But the specific policies that would allow for that deployment, those policies are different in different countries. So there isn't a silver bullet solution. Just because the US did the Inflation Reduction Act, that's not going to work in India, which does not have the capacity to give billions of dollars in subsidies. So you have to find the policy mix that actually works in that setting. And that is not to say every setting is unique. You can learn from each other. So the IRA might actually work in Europe if they really wanted to spend all that money. But what's working in China may work in India, right? If India is committed to trying to build an industry out because it sees it as a business motivation, as an economic benefit, it actually can start to build a clean energy industry, especially at a time where there is so much tension between China and Europe and China and the US, that India could be the place where you could get those technologies without having to rely on China for everything else. So that's my hope, that you will get these sort of mix of things, but they'll have to be tailored for the solution. There isn't one thing that'll work.
In your day job as a senior reporter for Bloomberg, and having covered the space for a while, you have such unique vantage points on global climate issues. And your book will be out by the time this podcast airs in the US. It's been out in Europe. I think you're coming to the US to talk up the book. How are you feeling about things right now on the global climate technology and policy front?
I mean, it's an interesting time. We're in 2024. There's going to be a bunch of elections. By one estimate, you know, half the world's GDP goes to the polls this year. And of course, India and China make up probably most of that. And what happens at the end of 2024 will make a big difference, because what happens in the US makes such a big difference. And so I'm looking out for that, you know, keen to understand whether what seems like a very robust set of actions that a government has taken on climate that is oriented not just to reduce emissions, but create jobs, create technology advantage, to create equity, whether that message actually lands. You know, after all of this, the way climate action will succeed is if you bring people along. And what does it take to not just have the technocratic ideas, but also the ability to explain those technocratic ideas and show the impact that they have on people? is what is going to unlock whether 2024 goes in the way of good climate action or bad climate action. And so very keen to see what 2024 looks like. And, you know, as a journalist, sometimes I'm thankful my job is actually to watch and learn and not be in it, because I can imagine it must be pretty stressful for the people who are in it. But as an observer, it is, there's nothing more exciting to look out for in 2024.
Great answer. I'm going to challenge you a bit, though. I have to ask personally, you know, how are you sort of managing your optimism and your hope for the future this year and at the end of 24?
You know, it's sort of funny because obviously the book is meant to look at solutions. And so by nature, it's optimistic because it's looking at the solutions. But it's not driven to try and make you be optimistic. I'm much more pragmatist. I'm like, okay, here's a problem. It needs to be solved. I suppose that's the engineer in me. It's not change. You know, you are shaped by your education and the circumstances you were growing up in. And so this is a huge challenge. It needs to be solved. If it's not solved, we'll suffer the consequences. And so to me, what is interesting is actually there is so much happening on trying to solve it. And the fact that, you know, I got into doing climate in the Trump era just sort of makes me a lot more resilient to the fact that actually really, yes, in the short term, everything matters, but in the long term, the direction is pretty clear. And yes, things will be bad for some people and things will be bad for some time, but the only way out is to actually do something about it. And nothing gives me more hope and optimism than just the sheer number of people involved in it. And that's why to me, as an observer, as a journalist, it's the best time to be a climate journalist. You just get to be able to observe the world changing in front of you and to be able to tell the people around you why and how and what you can learn from it.
Wow. How about feedback, reactions, positive or negative thus far? What are you hearing?
It's been fun. I mean, my goal with the book was, A, I hope people learn from these examples and deploy them. I'm a journalist and my goal is to reach a big audience, as big an audience for the ideas and the stories that I have. And I was told, you know, a book is a different beast. You get to, A, spend a lot of time with it. And so you have to struggle through it. But B, it also reaches a different kind of audience. And that has proven to be the case. I feel like I've ended up in spaces that I would not usually end up in. And that's been really nice. Some of it I expected, which is like people are like, oh, this is optimistic. And I'm like, yeah, because it's about solutions. I'm not trying to tell you what's going wrong with climate. There are plenty of books that do that. You know, go read The Uninhabitable Earth if you want to feel the force of what climate change can be if you don't do anything about it. So yes, that's been the case. Yes.
I thought it was great that the author, David Wallace Wells, gave you a book blurb. So even he, the writer of the ultimate doom text, which was great, but
yes, it was.
And then you also had the Kim Stanley Robinson, who wrote the, you know, very dark apocalyptic climate fiction books. She was inspired by your book. So tell those folks to look at the back cover.
Yes, exactly. So that was one. The other one has been this sort of expected pushback on like, oh, capitalism, and everybody rolls their eyes. And I feel like the phrase capitalism just means everything wrong to some people. And then you can't really disintegrate that. And I hope people can look past the fact that this is not about defending capitalism. It's about making capitalism work for the problem. And here are the examples of it. And so that is, you know, again, an expected one. I would say unexpected ones have been that the nuance with which I have been asked questions in audiences that I've been to has been amazing. Just the level of understanding that I, as a journalist, you know, my job is to know what is it that's missing in the public discussion. And
they're stumping you at
Sometimes I am stumped by how much they know. And sometimes I'm like, maybe I really don't need to explain how batteries work anymore. Or maybe I really don't need to say what, you know, what the challenges with the grid are. I can just assume some of these things as I explain them. But yeah, so that to me has been fascinating. You know, like many of the places I go, people haven't read the book. They're going to buy the book or they're going to get the book. And so after a 10-minute discussion about what the book is about, they already have a ton of questions. Because at some level, at least in these audiences, they've all grappled with climate and energy and the transition. And they all have questions, which has been fascinating.
I know these are heavy lifts, but if you're writing a follow-up, let's say in 5 years, guesses on which sort of themes and chapters you're covering, maybe not people. I mean, what came to mind was like, you know, one about how AI saved us, or is there a hydrogen chapter?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that are missing in this book because there's so many solutions that are not working at scale. You know, technology-wise, yes, hydrogen, lab-grown meat, regenerative agriculture, even carbon capture, it's not really working at scale right now. You know, carbon removal is not working at scale. I have a chapter looking at the biggest project, but it's really quite tiny compared to what will be needed. But that's just technology. I think there are systemic levers that are not working right now, right? Global finance isn't working for climate right now. We don't know how to get trillions of dollars invested from developed economies into developing countries. You know, we don't know how to compensate people. Yes, we've got a loss and damage fund. There's very little money in it. We just don't know how to give that money out, you know, what that structure is going to look like. And of course, all of this has to happen in a period where we are seeing this, the politics of the right, where people are using climate action as a wedge issue to try and stoke unfounded worries about the cost of the transition or the freedoms that are being taken away. And I think that is such an interesting point. And I would love to be able to figure out, you know, maybe if I write a next book, and it's a big ordeal, but, you know, how do you bring along people on this transition? I don't think we've done enough of that. We've not done enough of that at scale. Many of the solutions we've deployed so far have been technocratic and haven't required sort of the public to come along for that journey. But I hope by 2030, by the end of this decade, we'll have many examples of how we've done that.
What advice do you give to aspiring journalists who want to specialize in climate reporting?
I think some of this is like really basic advice that I would give to anybody who's interested in journalism, which, you know, right now, given the business model, is a tough sell to start with. But if you're committed, well, be curious. Write a lot, because the only way to learn is feedback. That's how I've become a journalist. I never got training. I just learned from doing it. And for climate people, don't fear complexity. Feel like there is a tendency to want to try and tell the simple story. And that is a bad instinct to have in climate specifically. I think that's a bad instinct to have in general, but specifically in climate, the nuance is as important as then simplifying that nuance to tell a rich story.
Do you have a favorite passage from the book? You've got some stuff for the ages here, so I want to give you a chance.
If you go to the last chapter, this bit, which is, the fight isn't for one group to stop the other, but for everyone to work together. This battle to create a new economic system, climate capitalism, will dominate the agenda for decades to come. And it is crucial that we understand it if we are to safeguard our planet for generations to come. Given the disruption that's coming, the race to zero emissions is unlikely to be smooth. And if history is a guide, it will probably be a series of missteps. Still, all the main forces needed to tackle this problem, politics, technology, finance, are headed in the right direction, with more and more people diverting their focus to the solutions.
Yes. Akshat, thank you for this.
Thank you. This was a fun conversation.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please leave us a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. It really helps us reach more listeners. You can also let us know what you thought via Twitter at @ClimatePosiPod or email us at climatepositive@hassi.com. I'm Gil Jenkins, and this is Climate Positive.